And now, as our reward for our Health Report podcasters, as each week we will answer some of your questions. And what's the email again with my dementia? I can't remember.
I won't ask you any dementia questions this week. It's healthreport@abc.net.au. And just quietly, this is my favourite part of the show. So if you're listening, you're our favourite too.
Good. What's going here?
Norman, let's start with this question from Ange. She's wanting to know more about the Bruelli ulcer. It's been affecting more and more people around some suburbs of Melbourne and now more recently closer to the CBD. Ange has heard that it might be linked to possums and mosquitoes. Is that correct? And she wonders if possums could be vaccinated to stop them from spreading it.
Yeah, well, actually in Victoria, it's called the Bairnsdale ulcer because it was first noticed down in the Latrobe Valley going towards Bairnsdale. And in fact, most Australian cases are in fact in coastal Victoria. It's a mycobacterium, which is the same family as leprosy and tuberculosis. It causes a spot and then an ulcer, which can be very difficult to treat using a combination of antibiotics and surgery. It's very common in some low-income countries where it is called Bruelli ulcer rather than the Bairnsdale ulcer. And some people think that it might be spread by mosquitoes. You can certainly find it in other animals. There probably is an animal vector here, but other people have thought, well, you can just get it by going through the bush and picking it up from the vegetation. So it's not entirely understood how you catch it, but it can be really quite debilitating and it needs to be got on top of and clearly has moved in from the country to the city.
Yeah, tuberculosis and leprosy are both really hard to treat because they're such slow-growing bacteria. Is it the same with the Bruelli / Bairnsdale ulcer?
Yes, that's absolutely right. And it becomes what's called indolent.
Such a great word.
But the thing about indolent is that most antibiotics and treatments rely on fast-growing bacteria, which you can then attack and get into. Whereas when it's slow growing, you don't have a kind of metabolic weak spot to get into it. And that's probably one of the reasons. They're just very difficult organisms to treat.
Mm. A very different kind of question from Helen, who says, should massage oil like sweet almond oil that's applied to the skin and be absorbed and counted as calories? In other words, if Helen is being mindful of her energy intake, does oil on the skin count?
You know, I've often wondered that. I had a look for it and I don't think anybody actually really knows. It's certainly true that you absorb oil that you rub into the skin that will get into your bloodstream, and if it's metabolizable, then it will be transferred to calories. But a lot of it will be trapped in the outer layers of the skin, which the blood doesn't get to. So how much actually gets into the body is probably quite limited. So that makes you feel better for your massage, I think. So I don't think there's a direct relationship between obesity and massage.
Right. Anne's asking about her elderly aunt has rheumatoid arthritis in her hip and she's in a lot of pain. And the specialist has mentioned something called platelet-enhanced plasma that would be injected as an option. Have we looked at this before and what's the evidence say about this?
Let's back up a little bit with things that you inject into the joints. So there are various things you can inject into joints when you've got osteoarthritis that can make you feel better. A lot of doctors now would not advise injecting steroids. There is a substance which is a bit like the filler you put on your lips, which you can put hyaluronic acid, which you can put into the joint, which helps to lubricate it and last maybe for about 3 months, but there's only limited value. There was a trend there for a while of injecting stem cells into the joint, and it got some improvement. But in fact, what they found was that when you did placebo trials or studies of the stem cells, it wasn't the stem cell, it was the fact that you were irritating the joint and causing a bit of bleeding that actually caused the pain relief. So stem cells did work, but it wasn't the stem cells, it was actually the injection, which made people say, well, why don't we just inject blood products like platelets? So you take the blood and you spin it right down and you re-inject it back into the joint. And apparently it does work. It does relieve pain for a while in osteoarthritis. I'm not aware that you would take the risk with rheumatoid arthritis, or good studies have been done, but there is some evidence that it works in osteoarthritis. You know, it's pretty major. And if you've got a joint, let's say that you've got a sore knee and you've got osteoarthritis of the knee and you want to try and delay a knee replacement. Certainly what you don't want is an arthroscopy with a clearing out, because that can speed your progress to needing a knee replacement. Something like this might help you delay it. And I really do think that you need to talk to your rheumatologist about it if you've got rheumatoid, because rheumatoid is an immune response to the lining of the joint, and you don't want to actually play with that too much. But in terms of delaying knee replacement, you know, strengthening your quadriceps, physiotherapy, hydrotherapy, those sorts of things, same sort of things as for your hips, for osteoarthritis, the hip can delay it and, in fact, take some people off the waiting list altogether. So there are things that you can do that don't require an injection to the joint. But anecdotally, some people do get a benefit from platelet-enhanced injections.
And one last question from Richard, who's talking about a friend of his, a young woman who's recovering from anorexia and has some mental health issues, which is sort of beside the point. The question that Richard is asking is antipsychotic medications. He's noticed in a few friends of his who've had it, they've had big weight gain after being put on antipsychotics, and he's wondering why this could be.
Yep, it's a major problem with antipsychotic medications, and it's why some people with schizophrenia don't like taking them, because they do put on weight and you can increase the risk of type 2 diabetes. So there are major side effects, and there hasn't been enough research yet into antipsychotics which don't do this. Some of them have a lower risk of that than others. And if you want to minimize the chance of weight gain, you need to talk to your psychiatrist about which one might be best for you. Also, if you do exercise, and there are some other drugs that you can take with them, like metformin, which can mitigate the weight gain. The reason for the weight gain is not entirely clear, but it's from animal research that suggests that the antipsychotics do affect a receptor in the brain, which increases appetite, at least in animal models, and decreases activity. So these antipsychotics work by influencing neural receptors in the brain, chemical messengers. They're not that targeted, and one of the side effects is that it's obviously affecting the appetite center and perhaps even the desire to take exercise.
Right, so interesting. Well, that's all we've got for you in our mailbag tonight. But as we said before, healthreport@abc.net.au is the email address to send your questions and comments to. We encourage you to do so.
And we'll see you next time.
See you then.